From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George W. Bush campaigned for president under the banner of compassionate conservatism, but Pat Buchanan isn't feeling the love. The one-time presidential candidate and longtime conservative crusader looks at George W.'s White House and sees an administration weak on its right flank, selling out to the forces of big government and sinking in the quagmire of post-war Iraq, a war, Pat Buchanan says, brought about by the folly of George W. Bush and his coterie of wargaming Washington neocons. Buchanan-style conservatism doesn't take kindly to muscle-flexing neoconservatism, and Pat Buchanan isn't alone. There's a new shiver of worry in the American right. Former Reagan administration figure and self-styled traditional conservative Clyde Prestowitz wrote just yesterday that the neocons are at odds with fundamentally conservative American values. So what's the real scorecard on the Bush White House? Tonight on Point, Buchanan on Bush, the conservative critique of George W. and neoconservatism. What's your take on Buchanan conservatism? Do you buy Pat Buchanan's assessment of a weak on the right George W. Bush? Are neocons radicalizing the American right or leaving it behind? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Pat Buchanan, editor of the American Conservative magazine, three-time presidential candidate and author of The Death of the West. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Pat Buchanan.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
Good to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Welcome back. And hello, Pat Buchanan.
How are you? Up in my
All
favorite
right.
state.
That's right, the Buchanan Brigade.
The Buchanan Brigade, good old New Hampshire, and the lights
I'm out
will be
there sharpening my pitchfork.
watch out, you two. Pat Buchanan, you're coming out with guns blazing here on George W. Bush recently. This sort of critique from the right, and we'd like to hear more of it. You say you've written just recently that George W. Bush is in more trouble than he realizes. You said the wisdom of the father in disregarding the neocons and the folly of the son in heeding them have become apparent. This was in particular in regard to Iraq you were writing, but your critique is more general. Paint it for us. What's your problem as a conservative with the neocon direction that this administration has taken?
Well, neoconservatism is basically a political philosophy of many liberals who are on this, what you might call the Scoop Jackson, Hubert Humphrey, Lyndon Johnson wing of the Democratic Party, who bolted to the Republicans when McGovern took over, and they and their offspring have now come to almost redefine conservatism in the mind of the Beltway and in terms of columnists and commentators. And to me, it's an inauthentic conservatism because what it is what you might call dressed-up Wilsonianism. They believe in globalism. They believe in militant interventionism for democracy abroad. They are global free traders. They have no real problem with big government. They are accommodationist on social and cultural and moral issues, which are of deep concern to traditionalists. And they really are not of the, they're not of the faith. They've simply hijacked the great name of conservatism. And in that name, they are trying to play the role of the opposition and, of course, the incumbent in power. And I think it's a disservice to conservatism, and it's a disservice to the country.
Pat Buchanan, I want to dig into those issues one by one, but before we go there, this was not the message that George W. Bush delivered in his campaign. How did it come to pass, in your view, that this crew became so dominant in this Bush administration?
Well, they really came in and they surrounded Mr. Bush, and Richard Perle, who's a prominent neoconservative, said himself he was astounded at how vapid or basically shallow President Bush was when he was a candidate, but fortunately he could be tutored well and he would study and he learned all the lessons of what they called the Vulcans. And these are the neoconservatives, Wolfowitz, Perle, and the others, who moved in and basically took over the foreign policy of the Bush administration, with this exception. At the top levels, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Powell, etc., many of them go back to other traditions which are not neoconservative. But below them, there's a tremendous number of neoconservatives there who have persuaded Cheney and Rumsfeld especially that an interventionist foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, preemptive war if necessary, take down 5, 6, or 7 Arab radical states and Iran, quote, World War IV, as they call it. This is the mission of George Bush. After 9/11, Bush went after Afghanistan, but when that was done, they put this pre-cooked meal in front of him, in my judgment, and he dipped into it, and he plunged into it, and that's behind the war in Iraq. All this weapons of mass destruction, all the rest of it, turns out to have been exaggerated at best.
So did he tuck into this meal, Pat Buchanan, because it lined up with the real thinking of George W. Bush, or it lined up with his personality, his character somehow? I mean, why not more
good
of a
question.
Scowcroft, a Jim Baker line? Why turn to that channel at that moment?
I think it conformed to the personality of George Bush. I think George Bush at 9/11 was really a road to Damascus moment for George W. Bush. He had been a lackadaisical president before then. He was down at 50% in the polls. He didn't seem to be terribly engaged in it. And I think he decided that this is his providential mission. It is to win the war on terror. And I think he handled the war in Afghanistan magnificently. I think he showed patience. I think they handled it in the right way in terms of not overdoing the bombing. They were precision bombing. They sent in special forces, dumped over that wretched regime, and ran the al-Qaeda to earth. But when that was done, I think a lot of us felt, now we've got to run down al-Qaeda around the world. It's not very, you know, it's not very exciting and dramatic.
It's police work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And working within one after another, just like running down the IRA, only it's worldwide. But I think at that point, Wolfowitz and the others persuaded Rumsfeld and Cheney, who persuaded the president, that Iraq, taking down Iraq, preventing Iran, Iraq, and North Korea from getting nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, this was the way to winning the war on terror, take down one after another after another. And I think the president was resolved in his own mind. He was committed. You could see the fire in the eyes. He was a true believer. And I think he went ahead and did it. And he's now awakening to the fact that the United States has hit the tar baby. And we are in there. And as Dean Rusk used to say, we are there and we are committed.
So who owns, then, the idea of conservatism in the United States today? You're writing that this is a tar baby, this is folly. We quoted Clyde Prestowitz saying this is out of line with traditional American conservative values. But George Bush has fairly strong conservative support in the polls.
Well, he's got very strong conservative support among Republicans and natural conservatives because, first off, a lot of Americans supported the idea of victory in Iraq and winning, defeating Saddam Hussein. They were sold the same bill of goods. They believed it. They bought into it. They said, we can't wait this time for 9/11. We can't wait for him to hit us like that. And if we got to go in and get the job done, that's a very American attitude. And so I think they supported the president, but the president's support has now begun to fall because people realize what we are in for here and that we were, in a sense, sold a bill of goods about democracy breaking out and the flowers being tossed at American troops and democracy spreading to Iran and Saudi Arabia. So I think the president has a problem here. Now, I will say this. The neoconservatives have hijacked the conservative movement. They control the money foundations, Bradley, Olin, and these others, that finance the think tanks, and they have moved into the think tanks like AEI, American Enterprise Institute,
right.
100% neocon. It was used to be run by a Lebanese-American named William Baroudi Sr., a very good friend of mine, who was an old-style conservative. All these foundations were old-style conservative. So you've got your, let me give you a rundown. Your magazine's National Review is old-style conservative, is 100% neocon. Weekly Standard is a neocon magazine. Obviously, Commentary is. And the New Republic. I think you will find the American Conservative, which I write for, is conservative, old right. Chronicles is, Middle American News is, Human Events is sort of conflicted, if you will.
But overall, with those think tanks gone that way, with all these publications gone that way, with the president and the executive branch gone that way, have the traditional conservatives lost the battle? Are neoconservatives the new conservatives?
Well, they clearly have. They are in the ascendancy, undeniably. However, what's going to bring it back, and what has already begun to bring it back, is the fact that the neoconservative policies are fundamentally Wilsonian policies, and they fail. Now, let me give three examples. One is this intervention in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Lord help us. If we do not stop these attacks on Americans and they escalate and you get these jihadists coming in there, shooting Americans repeatedly, the president's going to have to make a case for why we stay in there. Or by next year, as I think I wrote in that article in Atlantic, you're going to have somebody's going to stand up and say, support our troops, bring them home now. And it's going to have tremendous resonance. Secondly, neoconservatives are big government conservatives. And we now have about a $450 billion deficit. And that's going to come home to haunt us. Third, they are free traders. And the merchandise trade deficit in May hit $562 billion.
That's way up there.
We have lost 2.5 million manufacturing jobs alone under Mr. Bush. One in every seven manufacturing jobs in America has disappeared. The number of Americans in manufacturing as a share of the labor force is about what it was in the administration of Andrew Jackson. Now, these policies, the chickens are coming home to roost. I just watched part of that Democratic debate. They're all hammering this loss of manufacturing jobs and these trade deals. So what was decried and denounced as Buchananism in 1992, where we broke with the neoconservatives and broke with Bush Sr., I think is going to come around. There's no doubt we have not been in the ascendancy of the last 10 years. Mm. We've been back out in the wilderness, which is where we were when we were working for Barry Goldwater.
Jack Beatty, let me bring you in here. You and Pat Buchanan write back-to-back in the September issue of The Atlantic about politics and Bush and conservatives, neoconservatives, and all the rest. What do you think? Are the old conservatives dinosaurs? Is this the century of the neoconservative, or has it got an expiration date on it, as Pat Buchanan suggests? Is George Bush going to be bitten by this?
Well, I never thought I'd be nostalgic for Ronald Reagan, but when I look at these two presidents, I really come out on the other side from Pat, at least on the judgment that Bush isn't conservative enough. I mean, he's righter than Reagan. Consider, in 1981, Reagan had the biggest tax cut in history. In 1982, amidst an exploding deficit, he had the biggest tax increase in history. And the next year, he had a Social Security tax increase to handle the problem of Social Security. What has Bush done? Huge tax cut year one, small business tax cut year two, second huge tax cut year three. As for Social Security, no way a tax increase. We're going to privatize it, which was one of Barry Goldwater. I mean, poor Barry Goldwater said that aloud and has never recovered since. In foreign policy, Reagan hired in security policy, his defense secretary got up every day and said, I will not use the military. Don Rumsfeld, just the opposite. Reagan, when he did his regime change, he hired foreign thugs. You know, you got the Contras against the Nicaraguan government. You got Joseph Savimbi, the ex-Maoist and cannibal, against the Angolan government, who made it, of course, Angola a wasteland of one-limbed children. And, and Bush, we're going to do the regime changes all by ourselves. Reagan, he recognized Saddam, helped us, sold him weapons, sent him Don Rumsfeld to butter him up, and Don tried to do a deal for Bechtel while he was there. Bush, hey, we don't deal with these people. We topple them. Reagan, he appointed a centrist. Who did he appoint as vice president? Centrist, George Bush. Who did Bush appoint? About the most conservative guy in the Congress, Dick Cheney. You can go on, but the record, if you compare like to like, as opposed to, you know, the abstract idea of conservative versus a practicing politician, if you compare Reagan and Bush, it looks to me as Bush is righter than Reagan.
Pat Buchanan, how about it? Jack Beatty doesn't want to let you walk away from George W. He says he's righter than Reagan, so he's still in your lap.
Well, let's take the one issue on which conservatives agree, and that is big government. Jack is exactly right. Ronald Reagan cut taxes, the biggest tax cut in history, and then he raised taxes twice, two huge tax cuts. I think he also threw in a nickel gasoline tax somewhere in there. Mm. However, Reagan did try to resist the growth of government. Look at the Kennedy-Bush education package, the Department of Homeland Security. This president has not cut a single federal agency or a single federal budget or a single federal program I can think of.
Pat Buchanan, hold the thought. We've got to take a break. We'll come right back. We're talking with Pat Buchanan on the conservative critique of President Bush and the neocons. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with three-time presidential candidate Pat Buchanan on the conservative critique of President Bush and the neocons. You can join the conversation. Do you understand why the conservatives are upset with the neoconservatives? And is President Bush a conservative or something else? Is traditional conservatism dead? Is this the neocon century or a neocon flash in the pan? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pat Buchanan, you were talking there about President Bush as the big government president. This is not a label he would run toward.
But it is not a label he can run away from either. Look, we do have an enormous deficit. Mr. Bush has created the new Department of Homeland Security. He does have this monstrous education program, which is anything but conservative. When I ran for president in 92 and 96, we got written into the platform, the Republican principle, that if we take power, we will shut down the Department of Education.
Well, President Bush has no child left behind, and as you say, he's joined forces with Senator Edward Kennedy.
Senator Kennedy, and with due respect, the prescription drug program, the president will accept virtually anything, which is the greatest new entitlement probably since Medicare. Now, I understand the politics of what he is doing, and maybe we've reached a point in our country where no one really cares, and we all believe that government can solve these problems. We're all willing to tell them to try and give them the power and the money to do it. And perhaps we are outside a conservative error, and simply Mr. Bush is more conservative, certainly, than Al Gore would be or any of those Democratic candidates. But this is not Barry Goldwater, Robert Taft conservatism, and that's what those of us who are conservatives believe. It's our duty, really, I think, to say, look, this is not what we were fighting for. We do believe in small government. We do believe in federalism. And this is not it. We don't believe in intervening all over the world. Now, let me disagree with Jack here on foreign policy. I was in Reagan's White House. Mm. We did not confront the Soviet Empire. The president wouldn't even put the Polish regime in default in 1981. We did assist anti-communist rebels in Nicaragua and in Angola and in Afghanistan. Now, these were not sweet people. None of them were. And we did cut off Mozambique when they turned out to be just murderers. We chopped them off, but that was the nature of the world, and Ronald Reagan brought down the Soviet Empire. He had a huge military buildup. I do not believe Ronald Reagan would be running all over the world the way Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2 did, intervening in Somalia and Haiti and Panama and every place else in this Bosnia and Kosovo and the Middle East and all the rest of it. He was a true conservative. He defended the country. He believed in a peace through strength, a defense second to none. He was not a mad interventionist.
I hear the defense of Reagan, but I guess I want to try and keep this as focused as we can on George W. And where you think the neoconservative thread or rope or cable or whatever, it's big, is leading this president. Where is it leading him in terms of his reelection prospects? Where is it leading George W. Bush and the country in terms of down the road, even past the next election, Pat Buchanan?
I think the neoconservative tide has passed. And I wrote that before they got into Iraq. I said, once we reach what the neoconservatives believe is in benevolent global hegemony. In another word, they believe in the American empire. It is our turn. We replaced the British Empire. You know, Max Boot, it's all, we're going to jod purrs and pith helmets. Mm-hmm. This is all nonsense. The American people don't. The American people were persuaded that Saddam Hussein was a unique, possibly mortal threat who's going to get nuclear weapons, turn them over to these terrorists, and we're going to have a 9/11, a mushroom cloud in my hometown of Washington. So they said, do it.
Was that wrong?
In my judgment, it was not a necessary war. But never was a necessary war. Saddam Hussein is Al Capone. He's a criminal and a thug. You can deal with him. You could have told Saddam Hussein, send out the head of Abu Nidal on a stick and show us your good faith.
Was there an impeachable offense in leading the country into that war then?
No, because this idiotic, due respect, The Congress of the United States cowardly and contemptibly in the campaign of 2002 gave President Bush the war-making power, surrendered it, gave him a blank check, said you go to war when and where you want in Iraq, as long as it's Iraq, and let us go back to arguing about health care during the campaign. So but, Congress but, surrendered its authority and the president exercised.
But you say the neocon tide has peaked, yet I see you predicting essentially a George W. Bush victory in the next election. Why wouldn't that just buttress the neocon voice
and
power?
Because the neocon agenda, Iraq is only Iraq is the first big hit. They want to do Iran. They want to do North Korea. They want to do Syria.
And you don't think they're going to get the green light?
They want to bring down Saudi Arabia.
And you say there's no more green lights for that, or they're going to go with it?
No, Bush doesn't have any green light. I'll tell you what the neoconservative objective, you can see it shifts. Right after the war in Iraq, it was to take down the Syrian government. Then there's a focus on Iran. Now, if you read the magazines, the focus is on undermining and torpedoing the government of Saudi Arabia, just the way we did the Shah and Somoza and Diem. But when that comes down, that will be a complete debacle if it happens. Now, I think the president has woken up and realized he's got himself into the big muddy over there, into this desert war, and that he had better, he and Rove is certainly thinking this, we had better find a way to transfer this to the Iraqis, to bring in international troops, and to get our guys out of there. And I think that's what they will do, and that is athwart the neocon agenda. Secondly, the best thing that's happened is something our magazine took the lead in doing, is exposing and outing the neoconservatives in the government. Because based in the government, outside, who they are, where they are, what their power centers are, because fundamentally it is a parasitical movement. You'll never find a neoconservative who's leading a great cause, whether he's wrong or right, a Wallace or a McGovern or a Goldwater or someone like that. They always attach themselves and they insinuate themselves next to people of power and do the memos and do that work. And they're very good at that. They network well.
Why should they be more given to that than conservatives or liberals or any other?
I'm a conservative. We work in our basement by ourselves. We are a different breed, I'll tell you. These folks network as well as anyone I've ever seen. And I've worked with them for years in the Reagan administration. I was with them, with Nixon when they first came up. And I work with them, and some of them were friends. They were constantly in your office, and they were working and networking and trying to get this done.
But they know what they're after. Jack Meade, I want to turn to you for just a second here. There's the notion of a neoconservative kind of conspiracy, but also the notion Pat Buchanan is putting forward.
They call themselves the cabal.
The cabal, if you will. But the notion that Pat's putting forward, that this tide has reached its high point, Jack.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with him about Iraq. I mean, Mr. Bush is at 53 now in the polls. 50 is where incumbent presidents have to start to worry. I suspect he'll be 50 shortly after Labor Day. There's only one way he's going to go in those polls, so long as Americans are murdered on the streets of Baghdad, 1, 2, 3, 4 a week. Now, Mr. Bush, unlike Mr. Reagan, who, when he lost troops in Lebanon, realized we had no stake there and just took them out, it looks like Mr. Bush is willing to stay there and fight to the last Kansas kid. But so I don't expect he's going to turn tail there before the election.
But do you see Jim Baker and Brent Scowcroft moving back into the White House here, Jack, or their ilk?
Well, wasn't it interesting that his first impulse when things were going wrong, or second impulse, first impulse was to send Bremer. The second impulse was to send Jim Baker to Iraq to straighten it out. I think that was very telling. He's back on the old support system, and in his heart of hearts, he can't be happy with what's happening in Iraq. I mean, he certainly doesn't want these kids killed. On the other hand, he doesn't want to have to be the president to admit that perhaps we've committed ourselves to something where we really don't have the kind of stake that would justify this sort of sacrifice.
And yet I don't see the neocons running out of the Pentagon and White House yet. I want to get some calls in here. There are a lot stacked up. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Mr. Buchanan, I think you're way too kind. Let's call these neocons for what they are. These guys are Trotskyites.
Well, some of them come out of the Trotskyite movement a long time ago, the 1930s, Irving Kristol and the rest of it. But let me say this. These guys are not Trotskyite now. They do have, if you will, the Trotskyite mentality of the permanent revolution. In other words, we are constantly at conflict. We have to, if we are not taking them on, if we are not crushing and defeating our enemies, they are defeating us. If you read Michael Ledeen's book, it does come very close to Trotskyism. But a lot of them, like William Crystal and others in their magazines, Fred Barnes and them, the only thing that you could call Trotskyite about that is the idea of this permanent conflict. Our enemies are in the Arab world, the Islamic world, Islamofascism. We have to fight them. We have to overthrow them. We got to get aggressive, you know, and we're falling behind. In other words, they're not like conservatives who are traditionalists. You know, I believe time is on America's side. I believe our ideas are right. I think it's like in the old Catholic Church, you know, we can survive dictators, demagogues, anything. We're going to be around when they're long gone. And that's the attitude of a conservative who wants to preserve this country and not have happen to it what happened to every single empire in the 20th century. Every single one went down because it overstretched itself in war.
David, let me ask you, when you call the neocons Trotskyite, is that what you mean, the permanent revolution, or something else?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're revolutionary doctrine. I mean, these guys use the terms consistently, but the fact that we've gone from the welfare state to the warfare state now, and really, to be quite honest, there's no difference between the two. I didn't vote for Bush for the plain and simple fact, and I'm a conservative. I consider myself, you know, an old right conservative, and I'm a relatively young man. I'm only 36.
Mm-hmm.
But you saw this coming, at least, you know, those of us within that wing of the party, based upon the individuals who he was bringing in. But you could see the conflict. But I mean, it was a major disappointment.
And do you chalk it all up to 9/11, David? Or?
No, because these individuals that he brought in with him, these guys had an agenda beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
This would have come down one way or another. But
you're a conservative then. Do you agree with Pat Buchanan that the tide's turning on this crowd or not?
Well, I guess Pat's a little more optimistic than I am. I hope that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Well, let me say the point the gentleman David's making is a very good one. These guys came in with an agenda. You can go back to Pearl and his advice to Netanyahu. We got to take down Iraq first. You got Wormser and these other people were writing for AEI. The U.S. and Israel should strike Syria, five countries. I remember when I first read that, it was January 1, 2001, and it came out of AEI. I said, you know, has somebody gone nuts over in this place? And 9/11 happened. And after 9/11, all things became possible, and that's when these fellas moved with rapidity, with their open letters, with their statements on TV. It was incredible the speed with which they moved when most of us were still in shock to get their agenda taken by the president. Just like, you know what, I wrote a column today. It'll be out Wednesday. I just finished this book by five. It's a good one by the ambassador Warren Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
It was Teddy Roosevelt and Lodge wanted to take on Spain, finish him off. And the battleship Maine blowing up in Havana Harbor was a godsend to these guys. I mean, immediately word goes out to Dewey. When war comes, you go straight for Manila. And they were way, way ahead of anybody. They had an agenda. They waited for the opportunity. And when the opportunity came, they put the pre-cooked meal in front of George Bush, and he dug in.
So what do you think would have been the proper response to 9/11 in that case, Pat Buchanan?
Oh, I think the president's response in the first 5-6 months was exactly right. You looked out there, if the Taliban aren't going to give these guys up and we got to take them down, he did the right thing. He got someone else to fight the ground war. The Northern Alliance got those crack troops in there and knocked over the Taliban, put a new government in there. After that, I think you go look, find out where our enemies are. Now, there are terrorists all over the world. They're in Colombia, they're in Northern Ireland, they're everywhere, Chechnya. Our enemies are Al-Qaeda. Our enemies are the guys that came after us and did this. I would have been laser-focused on that crowd, and I would have dealt with the people. You know, we had Syria. Syria's not a lovely place, but the Syrians fought with us in Desert Storm. I would have worked with any one of these people. I said, look, instead of saying, if you're not with us, you're against us, I would have said, if you're not against us, you can be with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would have been the proper to conservative approach, and this is going to be a long war. But I think all we have done, putting 150,000 guys, we put them where Osama and his gang can get at them. I mean, there was no people bombing the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad when Saddam Hussein was there. And now you're getting Americans shot down, shot in the back, and many of these guys coming in are jihadists. And all anybody who's a Muslim and wants to kill in America, the place you go now, just like it used to be Afghanistan for the Russians, it's Iraq for the Americans.
Well, Adam's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a quick question both for Pat and Jack.
Yeah.
Harkening back to something that Pat has said earlier about how Bush and the neocons don't seem to be at all in, aiming towards a small government. And I'm wondering, just watching their economic policies, whether they're choosing sort of a backdoor route to get there. Their policies seem designed to empty the coffers, and I'm wondering if rather than take the political hit of cutting variously popular programs, whether instead they're going to try and sort of strangle the government by draining its coffers of money and leaving the problem for an administration or two down the line.
But cut the taxes in faith that will mean a smaller government sooner or later.
Precisely.
That's what's called the strategic deficit. It was what they claimed, that Moynihan and others claimed Reagan had done by cutting taxes, growing the deficit. Mm-hmm. They basically depleted the government of all the revenues needed for new social programs.
So maybe this is a small government man.
Pardon?
So maybe this is a small government president.
Look, I think this could be the effect of it, but I don't think this is what Mr. Bush has in mind. Karl Rove has in mind doing what he needs to do to be elected. You go to Washington and the Senate and the House now, they're all pork barrelers. Even the so-called conservatives are pork barrelers. But the effect of it, this is what Stockman argued too back 20 years ago. You're right, the effect of all these tax cuts, you see it now in Dean's campaign. He's got a grave problem. He says, I would repeal all of the Bush tax cuts in order to pay for various programs. And, of course, that would be a hellish thing to attempt if Dean's in office. And, secondly, it does open him up in the year 2004 that he's going to raise taxes. And once people get their tax cuts, they don't think that belongs to the government anymore. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to propose raising them. And the last guy that did that is the late Walter Mondale.
And we know what happened there. Jack Beatty, what about it? Adam wanted to put the same question to you. Is this a small government president in the disguise of big tax cuts making, as Pat says, a strategic deficit that makes small government ultimately inevitable? Or is this just a kind of après-moi operation, devil take the hindmost after us?
Well, Karl Rove, in a little notice piece in the spring of 2001, boy.
How quick do they fly by?
told Nick Lemon of The New Yorker essentially this. He said, our idea, or the idea here, is just to create a permanent constituency for tax cuts by starving the government of funds. That'll be starving the government of services. People won't get anything for their taxes except the Defense Department and more of that. And they will demand more and more taxes. And so, yes, I think that is it's a kind of doomsday machine if you value government. These tax cuts win politically when they go through. They put the opposition in the hole, as Pat says. I mean, any Democrat who says repeal them is ipso facto in favor of a tax increase.
But Pat says he's a big government president.
Well, in the end, there's going to be a lot of contraction of government, and these tax cuts will have helped to bring it about.
Pat Buchanan, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking tonight with Pat Buchanan on the conservative critique of President Bush and the neocons. You can join the conversation. Pat Buchanan says the U.S. should get out of Iraq now. Do you agree? He says George W. Bush is a big government president. Do you see it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with three-time presidential candidate Pat Buchanan on the conservative critique of President Bush and the neoconservatives. You can join the conversation. What's your preference? Conservative, neoconservative, none of the above. And is it time for Buchanan in 2004? Is that what this is all about? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I think this neoconservative movement is a great deal more dangerous than what Mr. Buchanan would have us believe, and I think the Bush administration is cheek by jowl with them. One of their principal goals is to deconstruct democratic government as we know it and rebuild it in their own image, which is highly uncivilized. And I think the first plank in that reconstruction is Patriot Act 1 and 2, which is designed to steal from us our basic constitutional freedoms and protections.
So you see a full meltdown here. Pat Buchanan, how about it? Mark sees the full deconstruction of American democracy underway here. Do you go that far?
No, I don't go that far at all. As a matter of fact, if you go back which I just did, I read The Illusion of Victory, this Thomas Fleming book about Woodrow Wilson in World War One. You take a look at the violations of civil rights and the violations of constitutional rights under Woodrow Wilson. They were dramatic, sweeping, extensive. People who simply spoke out were locked up. Under Lincoln, we all know what a disaster it was. Under FDR, you had the people were hauled before grand juries. I think the American people now, and folks like our caller there, are so attuned and aware of any threat to civil liberties that they won't get away with that. I don't believe Ashcroft is in the same league as A. Mitchell Palmer. I don't believe we're under the threat that I know my friends write me and say the Patriot Act and Patriot II, these are that dangerous. I mean, when you go back and read what was done and you see what we are doing, I think we ought to be alert, but this is one apprehension that I simply do not share.
But what about it then? I mean, you describe traditional conservatives as having been kind of, on the run in the last year or two here. What gives you so much confidence? I mean, what's going on in the GOP if the neocon movement can roll to this kind of prominence and sway in policymaking? You know, where's the muscle of your conservative wing?
Our case was made for us by the failure of we came to power as it's a reactionary movement in a healthy sense. Much of the social conservatism and the religious right was in a reaction to Supreme Court decisions, Roe v. Wade and legalizing pornography and all the other decisions that helped unleash the social revolution on the country, and ours was a counter-revolution. And we were wiped out in 1964 when I was young, and in 38% of the vote, and mocked and ridiculed, and we came back in 68 for one reason. The Great Society had failed. The way they were fighting the war in Vietnam failed. The new economics of Kennedy and Johnson failed. That's exactly what happened to Carter. The policies failed. That was the only opening that enabled an actor like Ronald Reagan, who was widely distrusted and feared and thought to be a complete lightweight, could win 44 states against the President of the United States and then 49 states. Is it failed? Now, the neoconservative dogmas and doctrines, if they succeeded, look, if we went into Iraq and all of a sudden Saudi Arabia said, this democracy in Iraq is a great idea and we got to follow that. And
we'll do it too.
Right, if they were right, they would win. But they're not right. They're wrong. That's what will win for us.
Beth is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, as you might know, anybody from Cambridge is fairly democratic. And I can't believe I'm actually agreeing with the majority of what Pat Buchanan is saying. I find myself increasingly scared by this administration and all the sort of long-standing nepotism, if you will, that has gone on between the powers that be and all the administrations that they've all served on. And it just seems like this is sort of the culmination of a long-term vision that they've had about positioning the United States in the world.
And suddenly Pat Buchanan sounds pretty good to you, Cambridge Democrat.
Moderate to me.
Beth, hang on there. Jack Media, I want to put this to you. Here's a Cambridge Democrat finding the silver tongue of Pat Buchanan attractive this evening. How do you interpret that, Jack?
Well, Pat's making sense. I mean, he's talking about what we all read in the newspaper about what's happening in Iraq. I mean, he's not... I haven't heard him go past a fact, with his interpretation yet. I think he's right on. Any reader of the newspaper has to see that this is a disaster.
Well, Pat, let me ask you then, if it's as bad as all that, and George Bush is going to be the Republican nominee and then some, are you prepared to vote for a Democrat, Pat Buchanan?
Well, I have too many disagreements with him. About a third of the country are independents. I consider myself now an independent conservative. And we're not going to have a real candidate, I think, who agrees with me on the trade issue, on a non-interventionist foreign policy, frankly, a social conservative and one who will stand up and articulate our beliefs and values in the cultural conflicts in America. So the Democrats, you take Howard Dean, I thought he was courageous to at least he stood up. And even before the war, when it was unpopular, He said no. And all the other Democrats, to me, they were appalling. I mean, they disagreed with it. They were skeptical of it. And they gave up their constitutional right to decide when, whether, and why this country goes to war. They handed it to the president. To the president's credit, he said, I'm going to war. I mean, he told us in so many words, and we knew that, and it was up to Congress. Some of us went on radio and TV, said, look, you can't go to war until you get the authority of the Congress of the United States. And so we got the Congress to take it up, and the Congress turned its power over to Mr. Bush.
So Buchanan for Dean, is that what we hear here, Pat Buchanan?
Pardon?
Buchanan for Dean, is that the bottom line?
No. I like some of the things Dean is saying. But, you know, if Dean's going to raise all these taxes for government programs, I don't think that's the way to go. And there's other areas where I disagree with him profoundly. So, I don't have an ideal candidate.
You express a kind of long-term confidence in the American idea and ideals, though. Yet, you know, facts on the ground, as they say, are being created here in deficits and in other directions.
It's Kipling, you know, the gods of the copybook maxims, with fire and sword return. And this is my view. Look, Wilsonian interventionism does not work. I mean, I understand why people would like to remake that whole Arab and Islamic world. It is in horrible shape. I think they're going through something like what we went through with our Reformation and our religious wars. And as I see hopeful signs in Iran, after 20 years, the young people have grown up, and it's not America that they detest. It's those mullahs who are sitting on them, who can't run anything, and who are interfering with their lives. So I am confident that we can outlast this Islamic, if you will, this fundamentalism. It fails everywhere it goes.
Karl Rove is a pretty smart guy. Do you think he's going to be whispering enough of this in President Bush's ear in the next year that, in fact, your call for the U.S. troops out of Iraq might come to pass? Or is that impossible, given the oil fields and the commitment?
You can't do it now. I know what Jack said. And Ronald Reagan, one of the most courageous things he did, having put Americans in there were no vital interest, when we lost all those guys, I mean, Reagan got up and said, okay, it is not justified sending more troops in there, and we're going to have to cut our losses, and I'm going to have to take the hit on this. And he did it. That was a big man.
But well, we've heard right here that was the signal to al-Qaeda to come and hit the U.S. harder, because when you hit them hard, they run.
That's nonsense. Hezbollah, or whoever it was that drove us out of there, didn't come after us. The objective of those people in there was to get the Americans out of their little civil war. Mm-hmm. And we went. Now, Iraq, you got 150,000 people in there, and you've got the United States committed wholesale to democracy. You cannot. It's just like when we were with Nixon, we went in the White House. People said, why didn't you get out? We had 535,000 people in Vietnam. You can't just turn around and pull them all out. So Nixon tried to bring them out without losing the war. I think this is what Bush should do. We had Vietnamization. He should do Iraqiization.
How many years does that take?
But turn it over as rapidly as you can to the Iraqis, get other troops in there, and do the best you can, and get the Americans out.
Pat Buchanan,
I don't believe in just walking away from it. I don't think we can do that now, but I think Bush is headed in that direction.
Pat Buchanan, you've got us thinking tonight. We're out of time. We appreciate you being with us.
Well, it was a delight. I enjoyed it.
Pat, thanks so much for coming on.
And
Pat Buchanan.
Back in your callers.
Well, yes, we always do. Pat Buchanan, 3-time presidential candidate, editor of the American Conservative. Jack Beatty, I heard a lot of your song there, but not all of it, I must say.
My neck is tired from all the nodding I've been doing. Unexpected with Pat. He's made a lot of sense, and it's telling. Of course, one of the things Bush doesn't have to worry about is Pat Buchanan speaking to a Republican convention. He nearly sunk his father with that.
Not this time.
He
pretty well owns it. Jack, thanks for being with us.
All right.
Listeners, you can continue this at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, Arnold versus Ariana in California. This is On Point. Nearly 200 Californians now count themselves as candidates for governor in October's recall race, including actor Arnold Schwarzenegger, Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante, former baseball commissioner Peter Uberoth, and political commentator Arianna Huffington. The final list of candidates will be released on Wednesday. The sheer number of candidates makes any debate unlikely, but WBUR's Jeremy Hobson has sifted through movie soundtracks and talk show tapes to imagine what it would be like if two of the most well-known candidates, Arnold and Ariana, were to square off.
Good evening and welcome to the first debate in the California recall election. Governor Gray Davis has refused to join us tonight, and Gallagher is performing tonight in Toronto. So we're joined by just two of the candidates for governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ariana Huffington. Mr. Schwarzenegger, welcome.
I'm very happy to be here.
And welcome to you as well, Ms. Huffington.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwarzenegger, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Quiet. I want to ask you a bunch of questions. I want to have them answered immediately.
I'll do the question asking here, sir, if that's all right. Now, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I was born in Austria. When I moved to this country, I got a job teaching geography and physical education in Arizona. And then I coached basketball at an all-girls school in Rhode Island. But none of it made me really happy.
Mr. Schwarzenegger, let me stop you right there, if I could. With the exception of your Austrian heritage, everything you've just said is a complete lie.
I didn't mean to hurt you. I wish I was a kindergarten teacher, but I'm not.
That's quite all right. Now, Ms. Huffington, a little bit of information about yourself for our audience, please.
I'm a risk taker, and I risked my life, the livelihood of my two daughters.
What's that? It's a fire alarm!
No, Mr. Schwarzenegger, that sound just means it's time for us to move on to the second part of the debate. Now, Ms. Huffington, you were a Republican, and now you're a Democrat. What is it that attracted you to the Democratic Party?
Well, first of all, the Democrats are easier to shame. We must grant them that. Because the Republicans clearly see nothing wrong in defrauding the IRS, you know, unless you're a welfare mother.
Thanks for the tip.
Mr. Schwarzenegger, please wait your turn. Ms. Huffington, you were saying.
Basically, you can find fun parties on both sides of the aisle, I hate to tell you. Out here in California, we serve great moussaka, you know, the Greek dish, eggplants, cream, mincemeat, fabulous.
Shut up! Shut up!
I was at Harvard last week, and your phone number is still etched in the girls' bathroom.
Thank you for bringing that up, Ms. Huffington. There have been reports, Mr. Schwarzenegger, that you are a womanizer. What do you say to those claims, and what are your thoughts on women?
By the time they came to me, I felt there wasn't much I could do with them.
That behavior is piggish. There is no other description for it.
Stop whining. You are mine now. You belong to me.
Mr. Schwarzenegger, please.
You're not going to have your mommy stand behind you anymore and wipe your little douches. No more complaining, nothing.
All right, I think we'll just move on to closing statements. Ms. Huffington, we'll start with you. What would it be like to win the governorship of the state of California?
Well, humiliating defeat, you must admit. Especially with the whole Maria Shriver connection, the Kennedy connection.
Hey, come here. This is what I'm going to do with you.
Take a hike for Ike.
Mr. Schwarzenegger, your closing statement, please.
If you were a bird and lived on high, you'd lean on the wind when the wind came by. You would say to the wind when it took you away, that's where I wanted to go today. Where am I going? I don't quite know. What does it matter where people go? Down to the wood where the bluebells grow. Anywhere, I don't know.
All right, I'm not sure what the point of that was, but thank you both for being here.
Oh, you're not worth it. I'm pressing charges against you.
Uh-huh. Thanks for watching, and good night.
A mock debate between California gubernatorial candidates Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ariana Huffington, moderated by WBUR's Jeremy Hobson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus.